Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real-life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at ritaschulte.com. That's S-C-H-U-L-T-E.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. What does alcoholism, drug abuse, juvenile hall, teen marriage, a stint in a mental institution, gang rape, life on the streets, the suicide of a brother and a father, a broken neck, and a brain tumor all have in common? One woman, Linda Henningsberg. If you're wondering how somebody makes it back from all that and goes on to become a psychotherapist, you won't want to miss this interview. Linda's work has appeared in magazines such as Counseling Today, Psychology for Living, and Canicle Magazine for Women. You can find her at www.lindaheningsberg.com. H-O-E-N-I-G-S-B-E-R-G.com. Linda, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Your story is astounding. You have been through so much catastrophic loss. Can you start us out by sharing how you developed your panic disorder, the agoraphobia? You and I had kind of communicated through email a little bit, and you shared that with me. Can you start us out there?
Yeah, sure. I was always an anxious child, and I grew up in a pretty chaotic alcoholic family, so it makes sense. And I also think there were some attachment issues. My mother lost her brother to suicide when I was about 9 months old. And I had no idea that had happened to her.
So did that make her kind of like, unable to be emotionally attuned to you?
Well, I think so. And growing up, I thought she was just emotionally unattuned to anyone. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't figure it out because her mother was very different, very healthy, and so was her older sister. So I didn't understand what happened to my mom.
So did you internalize that, Linda, do you think? I mean, did you feel like something was wrong with you because she wasn't connecting? Yeah.
Yeah. I always wondered why my mother did not seem to care about me as much as she seemed to care about my younger sister, for instance. And it wasn't until I found out that her brother had actually killed himself when I was a baby that it made more sense to me. But she used alcohol to, self-medicate, and so did my father. And so it was a very insecure household. You just didn't know what was going to happen next. And I got through my teen years with a lot of problems, went to juvenile hall, got kicked out of high school, ended up getting married at 16 and having my firstborn son at 17. And then it was the hippie revolution back then. This was like 1969. And so I got very involved with the whole drug scene and just hanging out and listening to music, that whole thing. And one night, I just had this horrendous panic attack when I was driving home from a party, and that I didn't know what was going on.
So that was out of the blue.
That was out of the blue. And, you know, I had had plenty of problems with anxiety, but had never experienced a panic attack. And I didn't know what it was. I felt like, you know, something came down from the sky and landed on me or something, and I was going to die or go crazy. And that was the beginning of panic disorder. I began going to a therapist, and I was just nothing was ever explained to me about anxiety or panic attacks or what's happening in my body or anything like that. It was just a lot of talk therapy about, my childhood and my relationship with my parents. And so I just got worse and worse over time.
Yeah, I think that's something that's so tragic. I've had so many clients too end up in the emergency room like 4, 5, 6 times, and nobody ever explains to them the dynamics of what happens physiologically when we have panic. And
right.
That's so sad because, you know, educating somebody on that, having them understand that can help to dissipate, you know, a lot of those symptoms just by knowing.
Right. It took about I literally felt the symptoms of a panic attack every waking moment for over 3 years. I don't even know how I got through that time. And then it got complicated with major depression, of course, and some other things. And 3 years, about a year and a half after my first panic attack, I lost my own brother to suicide.
Oh, my gosh.
So that complicated everything for me, put me into tremendous grief and all that. And it wasn't until I went into the public library in my town and picked up a book by a woman named Dr. Claire Weeks about panic and agoraphobia that I learned anything about what was going on with me.
So were you not going out of the house at this, by, you know, with agoraphobia? You weren't going out, or how did that manifest itself?
No, I wasn't leaving the house unless I had, you know, my boyfriend with me or somebody that I felt like would take care of me if I needed to go to the hospital. You know, I was always feeling like on the verge of needing to go to the ER. And there were days when I literally just laid on the living room floor all day just trying to catch my breath because I was hyperventilating.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had no idea how to stop this process.
And nobody put you on medication?
Well, back then, it was basically Valium.
Okay.
And it didn't help. It just wasn't enough to really help because I had just no clue as to what was happening. I just thought I was going insane.
Yeah.
And then during this process, I became a Christian. After my brother's suicide, I became a Christian. And then I just had a lot of advice. And one of the things people told me was, you know, you shouldn't need any kind of medication because you're a Christian and you need to trust God and
yeah.
You need to, you know, that kind of thing. And so I cold turkeyed the Valium for God and almost put myself into the hospital again. So, but I did get off of it, and then I didn't take medication anymore after that.
And how were you?
I was terrible. It was just terrible. I still couldn't leave the house. I developed about 20 different phobias. You know, any situation that I felt trapped, whether it was buying something at the grocery store and having to wait for the checker to bag it, or getting gas in my car. Back then, you had an attendant who filled your car with gas. You didn't do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that nozzle went into my car, I just felt trapped, like I was, you know, going to go crazy right there, and I couldn't leave. And elevators, you know, there was just I didn't want to drive a car. If I did, I would stay in the right-hand lane so that I could quickly escape, you know, if I needed to. And it was just, it's hard to believe when I look back on those years.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you can't even believe it was you. Help
yeah.
people understand, you know, a little bit about this whole agoraphobia panic piece. We know as therapists that, you know, this stuff is driven by fears and strong beliefs. What were you believing about, say, getting out of your house or, you know, not being able to get into an elevator? Was it all about being trapped? What was the belief behind this?
Well, you know, I didn't realize this until I learned more about agoraphobia, but I think a lot of it is, you know, it's a fear of fear, obviously. It's a fear that you're going to experience a panic attack while you're out.
Yes.
And part of that fear is that then what are you going to look like in mm-hmm. front of everybody? And so there's a social piece to it, and that complicates it for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you could get rid of that fear that you're going to look like a fool or whatever, it would lose some of its peak. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So that was it. It was that, and I had such a problem with hyperventilation that a big fear was that I was just not going to be able to breathe. So I would get out and I would stop breathing and then what was going to happen to me. I was going to die or I was going to go screaming down the street.
Yeah, or I'll go absolutely crazy. But they're very real fears is what people need to know. They're very real fears. And unless you've experienced it, you know, I had panic, you know, a number of years ago, about 15 years ago, and I know how real it is, even though it seems, you know, we can laugh about some of them now. But the whole idea being that, you know, I won't be able to stand this. If I go to the store and I have an attack, what will people think? And if we're honest, you know, when we look at it, it's like, okay, well, what will people think? You know, most people will, you know, probably have some compassion on you.
Yes.
The other thing, you know, we'll think is, oh, I'll die or I'll go crazy or whatever. Well, the thing is, people have to know you don't die from having a panic attack. It's profoundly uncomfortable, but we can learn to tolerate that and let it pass. Fighting against it is not what we want to do. And I think the other thing you mentioned that's so critical is the breath. Generally, when we have panic, we tend to hold our breath or hyperventilate, like you were saying. Those are really bad for us.
You're right.
So we really need to learn how to do relaxation breathing and practice that so that, you know, that physiologically will kick our parasympathetic nervous system in and calm us down.
Yep. And that's what I teach first now.
Yes.
Is that, and I ask my clients to practice for at least 10 minutes every single day so that it becomes a habit for their body.
Yes.
You know, and otherwise you can't just pull it out of your pocket in a crisis.
Yes. So what would you tell people who are out there struggling with severe anxiety like you were and feel too ashamed to seek help?
Well, there's so much out there in the self-help world now. And there's so many books I could recommend, but you can go and look through books and you want to find something that will teach you the physiology of panic and anxiety, as well as give you tools for your body, how to calm your body down, how to stop the catastrophic thinking that takes place when you feel like a panic attack is coming on, and the acceptance piece, because like you said, if you would stop fighting against it, it goes down much faster.
Absolutely.
And so when you lose that fear of it, when you understand what's happening in your body and how your own thinking is perpetuating it, then you can just go, oh, well, you know, adrenaline is running through my body right now. It's going to be over in a few minutes, just like it always is. And then it is.
Yeah.
And then once that happens and you feel more control over the process, you lose the fear and then they just stop happening.
Yeah. The fear is so powerful. It drives it.
Yeah.
So dismantling the fear is really huge. And again, I think that, you know, psychoeducation piece really helps folks to learn, you know, that it is these chemicals. It is all this stuff that's going through my bloodstream and my central nervous system that's making my body so hypervigilant. I'm being armed for the fight or flight response when there may not even be, you know, any reality to my fears.
Exactly. I explain it. I go back to, you know, the days when cavemen had to survive looking for food in the midst of forests where there could be saber-toothed tigers, you know, and how our brain thinks when we think things like uh-oh or, you know, anything like that that signals a threat, our brain thinks, oh, we better drop a little adrenaline and some norepinephrine in there because she may need to run or she may need to fight something because your brain doesn't know what the threat is. And so then, but then we don't run and we don't fight. So there's all this energy in our body floating around that makes us feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, exactly. You said something a few minutes ago I want to go back to about, you know, when you became a Christian, you know, the church is saying, oh, you don't need medicine anymore. And this is, you know, this has been a historic problem through the church. You know, we get a lot of that, like, oh, you don't need medicine. You have Jesus. And not to minimize Jesus at all. I mean, he is the ultimate healer. But sometimes when things go awry in our brain chemistry, we may need medication. And we've got this other huge thing, you know, that we're all so aware of right now with Rick Warren's son, you know, committing suicide. This is a huge problem in the church, you know, dealing with this whole mental illness piece. How did that affect you when you were told, oh, you don't need medicine, you have Jesus? And what do you think we need to do with that within the body of Christ?
Well, this was back in the early 1970s. And the church was in a time of, there was a lot of, I guess you could say, voices speaking out on the whole name it, claim it thing. Mm-hmm. You know, what you say, you can have what you say. And if you have enough faith, you know, nobody should ever be sick.
Yes.
No one. And so what it did to me, it was very scary because I was being told that if I had Jesus, then I should not have fear. And people would use scriptures like perfect love casts out all fear.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, if I have fear, then maybe I don't really have Jesus. And if I don't really have Jesus, then maybe I'm going to hell no matter what. Maybe Jesus has rejected me because of my past sinful life, and I'm going to hell no matter what. And it was extremely scary to me. I came very close to just killing myself several times over this issue, just thinking, well, this is hell. I might as well just go and get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God that I did not do that. But I just grew as a Christian. I will tell you that God cares so much about every sparrow that falls to the ground. And those early years, every time I would reach a point of desperation, something would happen that, you know, was too much to be a coincidence in my life, that he just held on to me. And the worst things got, 3 years after my brother killed himself, my father killed himself. And I was on the scene for both of those events.
Oh, my gosh, Linda.
And so when my father killed himself, I was still at my worst as far as my emotional illness. And then to go over to the house, and there he was. And it put me in this terrible tailspin, and I felt like God had just shattered my heart because it was the subject of my daily prayers, you know, that he would not do it. I was worried that he would.
Oh, really?
And so that's one thing I related to with Rick Warren.
Yeah.
When his son Matthew died, he said that he had prayed for 27 years for him. And you just, it leaves you with this, and especially like in your book, Shattered, Rita, you talk about how our concept of God can be patterned after our parents and especially our fathers.
Yeah.
And when my father did that, then this God who I thought would never, you know, I'm being told he'll never let anything bad happen to you. Now you're a Christian, you're standing on the word, you're mm-hmm. living the life. And that happens. And I thought, well, he's just like my father. My father just, you know, devastated me. And God just devastated me. And then for a period of time, I became afraid of God for what he could do.
Yeah, like you couldn't trust him.
Yeah, I couldn't trust him. But I was also very afraid to tell anybody about my feelings. And during that time, I will tell you, Rita, that the presence of God in my life and in me was stronger during those days, during that next year, than before or ever since after that event. It was like I had a mantle of his spirit over me, and I was suffering terribly. My major depression took a nosedive, and you could have added psychotic features to that. And yet, he held on to me. He pursued my heart. And I came to this knowledge, just like Rick Warren did, and you've mentioned it in your book, Shattered, as well, that God is a good God, and that he cares about me, and that's what I needed to hang on to.
Wow, that's so powerful, Linda. I mean, because at the end of the day, that's what we have to decide about, isn't it? I mean, is God good
yeah.
even when the bottom drops out of my life, even when I have to experience these horrific things? But it's really so awesome that even in spite of the pain that you were walking through, that there was some part of you that felt this presence carrying you. That we can't discount that. Something
no.
moved you through this catastrophic trauma that you had lived, and you felt the presence of God in spite of it.
Yeah, and I have always believed that I could have been close to giving up, and that's why. You know, that's why he was so strong. You know, I know that not everyone experiences the same thing when they go through trials. And I've gone through trials since then where I've never felt that presence as strong as that time. And I just think that he was saving my life. Like, that's how serious it was at that point. Because my family had such a history of suicide, and those thoughts were so strong after my father's death. And he just held on to me.
How did you get through? I mean, you were right there witnessing these things. How did you get past that? How did you get past the images in your head? I mean, that's heavy duty stuff.
You know, this is pretty, I guess you would say, miraculous. Mm-hmm. When my father died, I was still suffering from deep grief over my brother's death. It had been 3 years, but it was so traumatic, and I was so close to him that I still cried every morning when I woke up. And then my father does it. And about 6 months into this, a woman in my church came to me one Sunday morning and told me, "Linda, the Lord woke me up in the middle of the night, and he told me the days of your mourning are over." And I had a lot of faith, and I thought, yay, tomorrow morning I'm going to wake up, and I'm not going to have this heavy, heavy grief to carry anymore. And the next morning I woke up, and it was still there. And I just thought, well, maybe she misheard God.
She missed God on that one.
Yeah. But what happened was, within about 3 months' time, the grief lifted. It was like when you have the hiccups, and then suddenly they're gone, and you think, when did the hiccups stop? And you don't know. You can't pinpoint that moment. That's what it was like for me. And it was absolutely miraculous.
Wow.
Because it wasn't something that I tried to make happen and that I've had to deal with ever since. This was like 1979, 1980, and I have never walked in grief since then.
Mm.
And so when I look at my healing over my emotional illness and all those things, I can point to therapy. I can point to working hard on myself. I can point to certain times when God had to step in and supernaturally lift something from me because it was too much.
Wow.
And that's what I feel about that grief.
At the front end of this, was it hard not to get stuck in asking the why questions?
Exactly. And I don't have any answers, you know, and then I just had to get to this place where I trust that God is good.
Were you ever angry at God, Linda?
Yeah. Immediately after my father's death, when I felt like he had just shattered, broken my heart, God had, I was very angry. And that was the piece that I couldn't share with anyone. I didn't feel like I could.
Because you were afraid that you'd be judged in the church?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was afraid that I'd be judged, and I was also afraid of my own anger against God. I was afraid that he was just going to strike me dead for that.
Okay, so you didn't feel like it was okay to be angry at God?
No, I didn't. And it, you know, I have come to know that it is absolutely, he can handle our anger. He has very big shoulders, so to speak.
Amen.
And he heals it. He cares. And he, you know, if we can listen to what he's trying to tell us each day, he can heal those places. And I think that's where he wants us to be, is that place of trust. You know, that just like the children of Israel had to learn that lesson over and over, because he just kept wanting to bring them to a place of, you can trust me that you're going to have what you need, and that I'll bring you to that land. But they just kept ending up in fear and grumbling and all that stuff. So we had to bring them to that lesson again, because our faith is the most important thing there is to God. And so that's where he wanted me, was to that I would trust him no matter what happened in my life. And they're hard lessons.
Sure. What mistakes do you think we're making in the church when it comes to mental illness today?
I think it's a lot better. I mean, it's 100% better than it was back in the 1970s when I was experiencing this. But I still think that there's some churches that look at mental illness and think that it's always a spiritual problem. And when I say that, what I mean is that there's demons involved, or there's sin involved, and that going to a therapist or a counselor is kind of going into the world for help that should belong in the church. And I think that that hinders people that are suffering and, you know, brings judgment on them for, you know, something must be wrong with them or they wouldn't be experiencing this. And I think that's the, that was the hardest thing I went through. And I think that people still experience that.
Okay. So after you're done with all of this stuff, then you get, you break your neck and then you got a brain tumor.
Right. That was amazing. So I fell downstairs in the house where I am sitting right now and broke my neck. This was in the year 2000. And I was home alone and stumbled over to a neighbor's and she got me to the ER. So there was that experience and I could no longer, I was the secretary of our church. So answering phones and being on the computer all day, I was no longer able to do that. But my dream since I was 20, in my 20s, had been to become a therapist and help other people. And so it was kind of a catalyst to start that process. And my husband was fully supportive of me. So here I was, 51 years old, starting college. And I, like I said, I had been kicked out of high school in the early in the 11th grade. So this was kind of a big deal.
Oh, Linda, that's just an amazing story. Tell us how folks can get a hold of you. I know you have a memoir you've written, and how can folks connect with you and read that?
Well, my memoir, I have, my middle name is Lockridge, and so my memoir is at lindalockridge.com. It's L-O-C-H-R-I-D-G-E. And then I'm also working on, I'm a certified dialectical behavioral therapist. And I have a website called changeyouremotions.com where I'm going to be offering online DBT skills courses and some other things too.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day and sharing this story of just incredible hope with our listeners. I'm just so grateful, and I just am so excited with what God's doing in your life personally. You're an amazing lady.
Thank you, Rita. It has really been fun talking to you.
Yeah, let's keep in touch.
Yes.
God bless,
thanks.
Linda.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at ritaschulte.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.